On this winter day, we're visiting the Glenwood Cemetery here in Washington, D.C. Almost every headstone on this lawn offers clues to a story, a name, birth and death dates, the location of family members buried nearby. And it's hard to imagine a story more dramatic or painful than the one suggested by the clues on the headstone at my feet. I've come to this grave with the historian James McGrath Morris. And Mr. Morris, could you describe what we're looking at?
Well, we're looking at a very simple headstone. It has two names on it. The top reads, Charles E. Chapin died December 13, 1930. His wife, Nellie L. Chapin, died September 16, 1918.
So Charles Chapin is buried with his wife. That's not unusual.
It isn't unusual unless you learn that Charles Chapin murdered his wife. And upon that hangs quite a tale.
This was a celebrity murder.
A celebrity murder committed by one of the most celebrated journalists of the time.
Charles Chapin edited the New York Evening World. He was one of the newspaper men who all but invented the modern mass media. Chapin's rise and fall is the subject of a new biography by James McGrath Morris called The Rose Man of Sing Sing. That strange title offers another clue to Chapin's astonishing life, as we'll hear a little later. If you take a walk through Lower Manhattan, you can see Chapin's legacy even today. Outside the City Hall subway station, a man is selling copies of the New York Daily News, with its headline you can read from 10 yards away.
25 cents, Daily News. Taking a cigarette break, get a copy of the Daily News. Give it up, cigarettes, get a copy of the Daily News.
In the early 1900s, newsboys would have been hawking about a dozen different papers, competing fiercely for commuters' spare change. Most of these newspapers had their headquarters here, side by side, on a street called Park Row. James Morris says reporters raced each other to bring back news for the latest editions, which sometimes came out every hour.
Where we're standing was a place you'd go for a real social occasion. This is, of course, the world before electronics, before radio and newspapers. And if a big happening occurred, you'd come down to Park Row, because on these buildings they had huge, essentially blackboards, and a little ramp, and members of the staff would come out and write the headlines, much like you see at Times Square now electronically. But this became such a rage that sometimes there'd be as many as 20,000 people out here. There's one famous boxing match that was held somewhere around the world, and telegraph results were being brought back in, and they hired marionettes to reenact blow by blow. And that evening was so popular they had to have the marionettes reenact it one more time for the crowd. And, of course, people back then dressed very uniformly. So the sight you would see here are all these hats cocked back at a particular angle.
Well, I know it's raining a little bit here and kind of cold. You want to step inside
Sure.
and talk about this some more?
They'll be glad to.
James Morris leads the way out of the rain and into the Beekman Deli.
It's nice and warm in here.
There's hot coffee behind the counter and a television in the corner showing an all-news cable channel. In their brashness and sensationalism, today's TV news networks are descendants of the old New York papers, and that would include the New York World, which was owned by Joseph Pulitzer. Pulitzer's best editor, Charles Chapin, drove his reporters and himself to find up-to-the-minute news of scandals and tragedies, from streetcar accidents to the sinking of the Titanic.
Charles Chapin was the man in the early part of the 20th century. New York people recognized him. He was feared. He was considered the master of his trade, and he was, in some sense, one of the lords of this street.
Just on the face of it, this is an unbelievable story.
It is. He had started off life as an itinerant actor, so he kind of saw life in the way that playwrights did. And so here he was covering some of the most gruesome murders the city had known, and he wrote them up the way you'd write a play. One moment he is given a tip that there's this man who had had an affair with another woman, which in those days was a crime. So he rushes to interview the philanderer, and while he's interviewing, the aggrieved wife walks in with a gun and shoots him right in the middle of the interview. So Chapin not only has the exclusive, but he's got a dead corpse on his hand.
Was he the kind of guy who would look at that dead body that just tumbled down on the floor in front of him and think to himself, man, I've got a good one here?
Exactly. He never understood reality in the way you and I might. I'm a parent, and every time I read of something that happens when a teenager dies in a car crash, and I'm a former journalist, I'm still moved by that. For Chapin, this was all fodder.
He worked for the guy after whom the Pulitzer Prize is named.
Correct. And one of the things that Pulitzer discovered is that the retail industry was beginning to use blaring signs in its windows to attract customers. And people like Pulitzer said, you know, there is such a thing as doing this in the form of a headline. So the headline began to grow. Secondly, he admonished his reporters to write in short, terse copy, the kind of thing that could be read by all of these people who are now becoming literate. And then the most important thing I think he did is he decided to write about his readers. So when we refer to this period as yellow journalism is considered kind of pejorative as a term of, you know, sensational reporting. There is some truth to that, but the other side of that coin is that's what the Upper Fifth Avenue crowd was referring to it, because they would open up the paper and they would see, you know, child plummets to his death from third floor building as mother watches on, and they'd say, oh, this is really, you know, sensationalistic matter, isn't it? In the Lower East Side, in a place like we're having our coffee, that's what we would be talking about. And Pulitzer and others discovered that if you write about that, those are the readers that are going to come to your paper.
And then he hired Charles Chapin as one of his editors.
Correct.
And how did Charles Chapin affect the Evening World and the newspaper world in general?
Well, in the sentence, Chapin was the best editor. He wrote the best headlines. He used Pulitzer's money to hire the best reporters. What you hoped for in New York was to get a little note on your desk from Charles Chapin asking you to stop in someday and chat, which was the first signal he wanted to hire you. And then he began pioneering some techniques that now are quite commonplace. He assigned reporters to beats and had them work around the city, and they'd stay in their area and get to know him. And this is the advent of the telephone, so no longer did a copy boy have to run the copy, but these reporters could call in. And then he got some of the most wonderful, talented writers in New York, brought them from as far away as St. Louis, and created a rewrite desk. And they would sit there and pound out copy all day for these hourly editions based on these short bits of information coming in over the telephone.
How important was accuracy to Charles Chapin?
He's more accurate than I would have thought. Because I approached that era with that sense that sensationalism allowed them to do almost anything. But over time, what I discovered is that Chapin really turns out to be a servant of truth.
Do you remember some of the headlines that he wrote? Stick with you.
Tiny tot with penny clutched in chubby hand dies under tram before mother's eyes. And that is a headline that sells papers.
Ow!
Yeah.
What set Charles Chapin on the path to becoming a headline himself?
Well, Chapin, as I said, had this very distorted sense of reality. This is a man who lives way beyond his means. He has no thought of the future. He uses his potential inheritance to parlay it into endless loans. Lives in the Park Plaza, has a yacht, has horses, lives way beyond his means. And when this world begins to crumble, instead of asking his wife of 39 years, to whom he was devoted, look, honey, would you mind giving up some of this stuff? He sees destitution, and the only solution he can paint is to kill her and himself. And part of that was based on the fact she had no family. There's no safety net in the United States at that point. And he really believed that he was going to be carted off to prison and she would be destitute. So it's a distorted crime of love. He waits all night for her to turn to a particular direction. He gets the gun and brings it to her temple, shoots her, and she may or may not have, but according to his account, she survives for 2 hours in his arms.
How come he didn't get around to killing himself?
I'm not sure if I can answer that entirely. He claims it was in part because it took Nellie so long to die that he kind of went into a trance. And he describes wandering around New York, and he says he came out of this trance when he opened up a newspaper at Times Square and saw the headline. And then he surrendered to the police. But part of it is he presumed he'd be sent to Sing Sing and executed. Fortunately or unfortunately for him, the equivalent of Johnny Cochran of that day came to his rescue and negotiated a plea bargain. So Chapin is convicted to spend 20 years to life in prison, but at 60, that's as much as a death sentence.
Charles Chapin died in prison 12 years later, in 1930. He was buried beside his wife, Nellie, beneath the simple gray stone that we visited with James McGrath Morris, the author of The Rose Man of Sing Sing. That title comes from the final chapter of Charles Chapin's life.
Rather than fade from public's attention, he ended up becoming famous all over again because he undertook growing roses, and he turned the prison into a series of acres and acres of gardens that were famous, that were visited by famous people from all around the country, and he enlisted the aid of House and Garden and other magazines, and as a result, rose growers from around the world contributed flowers, and at the end of his life, he earned a second moniker, and this was the Rose Man of Sing Sing.
What does it make you think about, that after committing this terrible act, he would do such a strange and...
Well, One of the words in the subtitle of my book is redemption. And having spent decades literally following Chapin's life, I'm unconvinced that he himself was redeemed. But the act is one of redemption, if you think about it. Sing Sing was a very dark, dreary place. And his final act in life, after spending a lifetime of chronicling the less good side of human nature, the murder stories, the seamy side of New York, his final act was to bring beauty to a desperate place.
And I suppose that's the kind of dramatic gesture that would have been appreciated by the kind of newspaper that he put out.
He would have loved to have a reporter write that story, and in some sense, I hope I did it.
Well, James McGrath Morris, thanks very much.
It's my pleasure.